The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Welcome along to Mark Stein's Stein Online's Clubland Q&A. I'm not Mark Stein. I'm Melissa Howes in for Mark today. It's 3 p.m. just outside of D.C., where Mark is just getting ready to give a talk about the Michael Mann case and Lawfare in honor of Constitution Day. We'll give you some more details about that later. It's 9 p.m. in Barcelona, Spain, where we will launch for our upcoming Mark Stein cruise next April. It's 8 p.m. in Southampton, in England, where our cruise will end, and hopefully we'll all manage not to get arrested as we disembark. And finally, it's 3 a.m. in Perth, Australia, where I enjoyed my first up close, not really interaction, but there wasn't any of the types of fences you'd see in U.S. zoos there in Perth with both a kangaroo and a koala, which was a highlight of my last visit there. It's also the home of my dear former professor, who I hope to see again sometime soon. There are a lot of questions today and a lot of comments about the interesting thing that happened yesterday with pagers going off. And it took me a minute to even remember. I was sort of trying to place myself back during the time of pagers. And I think they held on a little bit longer in northern New Hampshire, where I live, simply because they didn't need as strong of a signal as cell phones do. And indeed, there are still parts of northern New Hampshire where you can't get a cell phone signal, but you could get a pager signal. So we did have them, I think, in northern New Hampshire and utilize them a little bit longer than perhaps in more populated and geographically amenable parts of the world. But I was thinking, so on the pagers, I was remembering that there were, I think, two or three different options for plans with the pagers. And so there was a plan where you could just, you know, someone would call the pager and it would send you the number from the person that dialed and, you know, sort of no other information. And then I think there was like a second level where the person dialing could actually put in a different number than the number that they called from. And then, you know, sort of the big bells and whistles version of the plan was that you could get a message on your pager and, you know, call in to a switchboard operator and they would read to you, you know, a lengthy message that was left by the person. So anyway, obviously, and during that time, I'm thinking now, you know, at least 30 years ago, I guess this was. But, you know, sort of scrapping by. So didn't go for the bells and whistles version, but for the phone version. And you had to sort of discern, you know, if you didn't recognize the phone number, whether you were going to call back or, you know, what that was. And interestingly, it looks like they were actually able to, as I understand from the reporting, they were actually able to, you know, mimic the phone number of a number they would have recognized or thought of as coming from, you know, an official within the operation. And so they picked it up because they thought, hey, this is legit. This is a legit call. So I thought I might just sort of go to some of your comments about that, and then we can talk a little bit more about it on the other side. But it was an interesting, just thinking about pagers and a world before cell phones were ubiquitous. Eric Dale writes, how is it that the Mossad is able to plant tiny pager bombs in Hezbollah operatives, kill a top-level Hamas leader in safe house in the Iranian capital, but somehow completely missed the planning and execution of the October 7 massacre in the first place? I ask because there seems to be a recurring pattern in the West in general of catastrophic failure by those in charge, followed by greater power and budgets for those who allowed the crisis to happen in the first place. And Stefan Erler, I hope I'm not murdering the pronunciation of that last name. Dear Mark, thanks for doing these Q&As in your current health condition. Most of the news in the Western world is quite depressing, so I would like to hear your thoughts on what Milei is currently accomplishing in Argentina. It may be a small country, but he seems to be doing to the left what the Mossad has done to Hezbollah yesterday. Can Milei become an example for the right in Europe and in the North America? May this subject raise your spirits and bring hope to you and your listeners. Toby Pilling writes, could Mossad be hired to sort out immigration policy in the UK? They seem intelligent, resourceful, and able to get things done. And Alyssa Angel writes, how exactly can those Hezbollah pagers explode like they did? Is there an explosive device installed in each? I would have thought most of these devices would simply stop functioning and not go out with a bang. And lastly, if a pager can be detonated remotely, could a cell phone also be detonated the same way? Should we go back to landlines? And could the gizmos planned for human implant in our wrists and brains also detonate wirelessly? Oh, that's a grim thought. Welcome back to hosting Q&A, Melissa. Thanks, Alyssa. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your patience with me today. As you know, I don't normally do this, and I've jumped in today so that Mark can concentrate on his big speech tonight and give it the full welly, as you know that he'll want to do. So just taking a couple of the points there, I agree with Toby Pilling. You know, about the Mossad, I mean, my experience with the Mossad is fairly limited. But I think, as Mark mentioned in last week's show, I used to work in the U.S. Senate. And, you know, back again, you know, 20 plus years ago. But at that time, Benjamin Netanyahu, actually came to New Hampshire to speak at a campaign event for the senator that I was working for at the time, who's very pro-Israel. And I was really impressed with the level of security and the seriousness of the Mossad agents that were around him and that I interacted with. They were a pretty serious crew, and certainly I compared that to my experience working with Secret Service on White House events, again in the same sort of capacity, that they were much more of a cut above. Now, in terms of the technology, I'm not a technophile. I don't really understand how all of these things work. But I do think it's interesting that they were able to sort of access these through some interim manufacturer in, I guess, located in Hungary. And then today there's a whole new round of explosions with walkie-talkies and I think face readers and things like that. And so I don't know if those are coming through also the same Hungarian connection, or or a different one, but it's certainly, setting aside the obvious. I mean, obviously, we don't like to see any innocent persons killed, and there are reports that there were some, innocent children that were killed because they were in close proximity, to the bad guys that were specifically targeted. But setting that aside, it's obviously quite, I mean, it is impressive. It really is, James Bond, level stuff. And so I'm sort of in awe of how they're able to do this. And also a little bit nervous about what that means in terms of technology, that can be one day used against the rest of us. And it sounds like it's going to be, I think that's to be seen. But certainly it's, the idea of living off the land, living off the grid is looking better and better when you think about these electronic devices and, how convenient they are and how much easier it is to keep us connected with the world, but also how they could perhaps be used against us in the future is a little bit disconcerting. Let's see now. Olga from Arizona says, "Hi, Melissa. So nice to hear you. I'm happy to know Mark Stein is well enough to do another Hillsdale talk. Surely that's a sign of improving health. Are there any updates on the Ofcom case? Seems like we've not heard much about it lately. Thank you so much. Best wishes, Olga." Alyssa Angel writes, "Melissa, could you give us a status update on the Ofcom case? Is there an appellate process or was the court's decision final?" And Mary B. writes, "I am having a hard time keeping track of Mark's legal cases. Might you give us a little update as to where things stand?" Yes, some things I can talk about, some things I can't quite go into yet, and that's because we're still wrestling with some decisions. So just for those of you who may not have followed all the ins and outs of this, Ofcom, when Mark was broadcasting for GB News, there were two shows actually there were more than two shows. There were several shows that had been referred to Ofcom complaints about, Mark's content. And some of them, the Ofcom decided not to pursue. Two of them they did pursue. And these are now going back to the spring and fall of 2022. So they decided to pursue them. They were, both of them were related to the COVID vaccine. The first was in April of 2022, and it came on the heels of a show that Mark had done with Malcolm Roberts in Australia, who's, a great, has been a great advocate for bringing transparency to the vaccine approval process and all of that. So I think it was like the third week of April, he did a show on some statistics that had come out of the UKHSA, which has a whole raft of problems, which Norman Fenton can describe to you in far better and greater detail than I can. But the upshot of it was is that by looking at the trend in the data coming out of UKHSA, it made it clear that the setting aside the concerns of the vaccine to begin with, the first and second vaccines, the third vaccine was really pushing it too far, and that the ones that were getting the third, I guess what you'd call the booster, were having, a lot of problems. Mark was very concerned when he saw these numbers. He compared them to other numbers from around the world, including out of New York, and said, look, there's something going on here. I'm just paraphrasing. I'm not exactly what he said, but he said, look, there's something going on here. I want to do what Malcolm Roberts is calling for in Australia and call for a royal commission in the UK to look into this disturbing trend line. And his presentation was actually quite conservative, I would say. He didn't say, he didn't make blanket statements. He just said, look at these numbers. These numbers are indicating that there could be a problem here. We should be looking into this. We need a royal commission. It was pretty tame as compared to how he might usually approach something. And so he gave his presentation. He said, we need a royal commission. They all went into the vapors about it. And Ofcom investigated that. They took, almost a year to do so. The second show was with Naomi Wolf, Dr. Naomi Wolf, who had compiled a book about all of these papers that had come out in Discovery from Pfizer and sort of compiled all the expert opinions on that. And so she came on the show and presented her own information about the vaccine, her concerns about the vaccine. And people complained that Mark agreed with her too much, that he didn't push back on her enough, that he should have questioned her, that he should have, argued with her or whatever, which is, it's not really, this isn't a news program per se. There's a big difference between straight news program and a program of commentary, which is the show that Mark was doing. And so he didn't feel that was necessary. And in particular, because there was so much information on the opposite side out there, that this was just one small blip of information that was contradicting the official narrative that the vaccine was 100% safe and effective. So then that also, Ofcom said, okay, we're going to investigate this as well. Meantime, and I'm sorry if you've all heard this all before, but maybe it's a helpful reminder. So that was in October, the April investigation is still going on. The October investigation is going on. And Mark gets there in November to London. He's going to do the show from London for a bit. And it was interesting in that there was a lot of very aggressive attempts on GB News' behalf to get Mark to sign a new agreement, and one that would not be in Mark's favor whatsoever. In fact, they declined. They said that they would not provide the information from Ofcom's ongoing investigation to us unless Mark, myself, anyone else involved with our team back in America, signed a non-disclosure agreement that we would not disclose what was going on with the Ofcom investigation. And even more so would be a general NDA, so sort of applying to any of the interactions with GB News. And unfortunately, by that point, we had pretty strong indications that they were not going to stand behind Mark. And indeed that they would probably throw him under the bus with Ofcom. And so I sort of put them off and I said, oh, well, I don't think we need to sign that. It's fine. Don't worry about it. We don't need to sign anything like that. So I sort of put them off. They were kind of trying to make life difficult for Mark. Those of you who watch the show probably saw a lot of saw a lot of weird things that were happening when Mark would be on air. Technical, quote-unquote, glitches. And that sort of nonsense. And that was sort of going on. It was sort of gearing up. Mark's in London, and he's putting up with all this nonsense from GB and, you know, playing games with the studio time and, you know, having a teleprompter operator and just all kinds of silly stuff that someone normally doesn't have to worry about if they're working for a channel that actually has your back and isn't trying to basically, you know, force you to acquiesce to their will. So that's going on in November. So the first week of December comes along, and Mark is headed over from where he was staying. There's like a little bridge. I think it's called the Lambeth Bridge, but I think it's Lambeth Bridge, something like that. So anyway, he would cross over that to get to the studio. And in the course of which, and I think it was shut down, it was some sort of Armenian Independence Day or something like that, was shutting down the bridge. So he didn't want to be late for the show. So he jumped out of the cab and he ran across the Lambeth Bridge. I think that's what it's called. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. And then, shows up at the studio, and it's like 20 minutes before he's supposed to be on air. So quickly, you know, getting the makeup on, and he's sort of breathing heavy and his chest is pounding. And, you know, that's when he had his first heart attack. So it was just on the heels of all of this, you know, horrible pressure from and stress created by GB. And also in the wake of him having, as he has said in the past, he had the Pfizer vaccine. So never had any heart problems before. So he winds up there and he asks the producers, oh, could you get me some aspirin? You know, I'm feeling unwell. So they gave him some aspirin. He ignores it. He doesn't pick up on the heart attack symptoms, and none of the people around him pick up on the heart attack symptoms. And then he sort of continues that week. He's getting worse and worse. He winds up going to France on the weekend to, you know, visit friends there. And he winds up having a very massive second heart attack and winds up in the ICU and having to have, you know, surgery and all of that. But at that point, GB News went into overdrive in terms of using this as the opportunity to force Mark out. And so without our knowing, and with their false statements of support, you know, like sending flowers and crap like that, they went about figuring out how to force Mark out and do a deal with Ofcom so that they wouldn't receive a fine from Ofcom, in that they would agree that Mark was wrong and that they would do better, and basically Mark would be gone, so it wouldn't be an issue in the future. This is all in hindsight that I know this, and you know, this background information. So so we all know sort of what happened. So then Mark was supposed to come back. They said, oh, yes, come back. And then just as he's landing in London after this recovery period, they came up with this, you know, completely bogus excuse that he couldn't go back on the air until he had a defibrillator in that studio at the Westminster Studios. And that this was some insurance reason. It has nothing to do with him. It had to do with the owner of Westminster Studio. Well, I know the owner of Westminster Studio, and I spoke with him personally, and he said that was all BS, and that he'd never said that. There was no problem. Mark was welcome back anytime. I offered to go to, you know, I found a place where you could get a defibrillator delivered. I said, I'll have a defibrillator there, And they said, well, no, that's actually, so once I solved that issue, they said, no, that's not it. We need you to sign this NDA, this new agreement. And in this new agreement, you know, there's an NDA. And if Ofcom finds against you, you're going to have to pay the fine. And obviously, that's, you know, what you call constructive dismissal. I mean, they, you know, they could have done it the nice way. They could have said, you know, they could have said to me privately, you know, Melissa, we just don't think things are going to work out. You know, maybe this is a good opportunity. Mark's had, you know, this issue. He could just say he can't come back for health reasons and we all save face and everyone's happy. But Angelos Frangopoulos is a cruel and sick man. And so he wanted to exert the most pressure he could. And so that's how we wound up where we were. So Mark's out. They did their deal with Ofcom. They agreed with Ofcom. Yes, we should have done better. We should have done this and we should have done that on the two shows. And in exchange, Ofcom said, okay, here's your slap on the wrist. We're going to find against you, but you're not going to get a fine. We'll go along on our merry way. And so Mark's response to that, quite rightly, was, hey, you know, how come I don't get, I'm the one that's affected by this. I'm the one whose reputation is being smeared by this. And I haven't had an opportunity to actually present my case and why would I stand by what I reported. And so when the two Ofcom decisions came down, and they came down, I think, about a month apart. I think the first one came down maybe in March, and then the early part of March, and then the second decision in the early part of April. And so we said, well, we sought some counsel. And this was a little bit tricky for me because I'm American and I'm used to the American system, and I don't really, you know, it took a bit to sort of get on top of the how things work over there, and I don't think I'm still really on top of it. But we sought counsel, and we decided to file for what's called a judicial review, and these are traditionally pretty difficult cases to prosecute. You know, we wanted to give it a go. And we had, I think, some pretty good grounds that we had proposed for each of the cases. And both of the shows, there was some similarity in reasoning and grounds. So we proposed those. And we proposed those grounds, I think, in June. And then Ofcom responds, you know, there's sort of a little bit of paperwork back and forth. And then the judge sort of reads it on the written arguments. So a judge, I think it was Judge Lavender, in the high court, he read them and he decided, okay, of all the grounds that you propose, I'm going to let you go forward on, you know, X ground. So, you know, I think it wound up, there were like 10 grounds that we'd proposed, and he let us go forward on, I think, three or four grounds. And that was decided, and that decision came down over the Christmas break. There was, you know, I can't really get into the details of it, but there was a big sort of communications breakdown. And we were getting ready to go to court in D.C. in the Mann case right at that exact same time. But anyway, we wound up with a different solicitor. And they had to then go forward and say, okay, we'll go forward on these grounds you know, there's sort of a back and forth and paperwork exchanged. And then the hearing was scheduled in June, earlier this year. And some of you were there. The thing that was disappointing to me, well, there are several things that were disappointing to me. And one is that the judicial review process did not contemplate the introduction of new evidence or evidence that what Mark said was true, or that he should have been, you know, that the information was true, or that it was, necessary to present as part of his, you know, his call to action, which was to call for a royal commission, at least in the first case. And so, so the arguments based on what then that previous judge had sort of narrowed everything down was very, 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 very narrow. And it was on, you know, so it was just so narrow on these particular grounds. And which was really frustrating, because truth is not a defense. Indeed, I couldn't really hear, and those of you who attended court with us would remember this, that we couldn't really hear more than, you know, one out of every third word, because of the particular acoustics of that courtroom, which was overflowing. You know, we had an overflowing crowd there in support of Mark. She kept asking, you know, and all of the statistics that Mark presented, he presented several graphics from these official UK HSA reports on screen. And, you know, the judge asked the Ofcom's lawyer, well, that's true, isn't it? And that's true, isn't it? And I think it was four or five times that she said that. And they said, yes, it's true. But it's still harmful because it's not in, you know, context. And so, and they also, I think, Ofcom really, well, the lawyers, I think, are supposed to have, at least in the U.S., and obviously this doesn't always happen, but you're supposed to have a duty of candor to the court, so that if the court asks you something, you're supposed to tell the truth. Well, there are two particular things that the judge mentioned in her decision, which were absolutely, you know, bonkers. And one was that she hadn't been presented with information that that Ofcom had taken a position on the vaccine. In fact, that they had. You know, many of you remember those earlier cases. And I think it was one of them was ITV, where there had been a complaint to Ofcom and they said, well, no harm, no foul. Even if they said it was 100% safe and effective, it's not harmful. So that's fine. But then that didn't get before the judge. And the second thing is they kept citing to some big, you know, study they'd done 10 or 12 years ago, which was about presenting health information. Now, the report we actually couldn't find and had to ask for because it had been deactivated and put in the archives several years ago. And so this big report that they were using to justify their actions in terms of health and harm, health communications and harm and all this stuff, actually wasn't available to anyone to look at to gain any advice from. And second, when you actually read the report after we called them on it and said, hey, look, this isn't public, we want to read it, the report actually had nothing at all to do with anything similar to what Mark had done. They were talking about things where someone would go on and say, oh, you don't need to take chemotherapy. You know, if they had, Ella McPherson is a, you know, supermodel that famously has decided not to do chemo. And so, you know, she would go on and say, oh, don't take chemo, take this herb instead. But the call to action was always don't take the chemo, take the herb, or, you know, I have a stake in this medical device, so I think you should use that medical device or that drug. And of course, we now know in hindsight that a lot of these doctors, so-called doctors that were going on TV, were actually getting kickbacks from the pharmaceutical agents to promote these vaccines as 100% safe and effective. So, you know, I think there are problems with the judge's order. I don't really know yet if that gets us anywhere in terms of an appellate process. And our barrister has been on holiday, and so we haven't really been able to talk at length about appellate options. But just in my short period of time interacting with the legal system there, and sort of getting up close look at how powerful Ofcom is and how political it is, and really how one-sided the judge's decision was. I mean, usually a judge will sort of give you something to show how, you know, unbiased they were in looking at it. And she didn't do it. It was very brutal, the judge's decision, and didn't consider at all, you know, the effect of this on Mark, on his career, and really to a large extent on free speech and broadcasting in the UK, and on the victims of the vaccine who, you know, unfortunately, because of this, you know, it's not helpful to them to have this sort of decision. You know, sadly, it's a bad thing. So I don't quite know where we're at with the appellate process, but I don't think that there is, just generally, I don't think that there's a way to get a fair shake in the legal system in the United Kingdom. I think that, you know, what's happened since our case, just in the last couple of months, where they're putting people in jail for tweets. I mean, we're sort of lucky that she didn't jail Mark right on the spot for his commentary. I mean, I don't rule out the possibility that they will be doing that in the future. You know, putting broadcasters in jail instead of doing these Ofcom decisions. So there's a lot to weigh, but generally, I don't believe in the judicial system there. I don't think it's a fair system. I don't know quite where the next steps lie, except that, of course, Ofcom wants us to pay them $1 bazillion for their legal fees, which are like absolutely ridiculous, like extraordinarily ridiculous. And so that's sort of where everything is sitting right now, until the next hearing is held to determine, you know, any sort of appellate process and these charges, which they have refused to provide the detail of their charges. So we're sort of chasing them for that and trying to get on top of that. So it's a very long answer, but hopefully sort of gives you the full, you know, picture of what happened. But it's hard. It's hard for someone who's a third party going. Mark is not was not the recipient of the Ofcom decision, because that's a relationship between Ofcom and the broadcaster GB News. And even though he is directly impacted by the decision, he didn't have any say in the investigation process. Indeed, GB News kept Mark out of the investigation process for the most part, and indeed near the end didn't even share the documents from Ofcom with us in order that we could put on a case. And once you have that thing where GB News agrees with Ofcom, that's a very difficult thing for then a judge to come in and override. You know, if GB News, and not to be Mark Blue or anything, but if, you know, Angelos and that crowd had any balls and had decided to fight with Mark, that's a whole different matter. I think we could have been successful or had some measure of success in the courtroom. But once you've got that malign alliance between the broadcaster, the GB News and Ofcom against Mark, it's a pretty tough hill to overcome. And so I don't know, you know, what that means for the future, but that's sort of a very, very long explanation for the Ofcom case. Now, there was a question here about what's the, keeping track of Mark's legal cases. So the second ongoing case, of course, is the Michael Mann case, which, the jury found against Mark earlier this year. And there are several pending motions now that called post-trial motions that are before the same trial judge. And we have a few before that judge. And one is a motion for a new trial. The second is something called judgment as a matter of law. And that's basically where you ask the judge, hey, look, you saw the case, you know the deal, you need to come in and overrule the jury. Not least of which because the punitive award is totally unconstitutional. And then another pending motion that we have has to do with requesting sanctions for the bad faith of Michael Mann in presenting false grant funding information to the jury. So he claimed, you know, they did this big board that had $9 million on it. And the judge even said, like, he was shocked that they did that because he knew that that wasn't true and that that shouldn't have gone to the jury. So that's pending as well, this bad faith sanctions. The motion for a new trial is based on a lot of things, but mainly, you know, has to do with the closing remarks where Mann's lawyer said, hey, you got to send a message that, you know, people shouldn't say bad things about climate scientists. So you got to send a message by, you know, finding against these guys. And then he did this, you know, strange comparison to Trump and January 6th and, you know, trying to sort of invoke this emotional response from this extremely liberal jury in which every single one of them thought climate change was, you know, a, quote, existential crisis, you know, big problem. So that's where that sits. And the trial judge hasn't responded yet. Now, to be fair, he's looking at like 14 different motions, not just ours, but our co-defendants' motions. Mann's got some motions in there. So he's got a lot of work to do. Meanwhile, Mann has already taken it to the appellate court. So he's gone to the appeals court and say, hey, I'm going to be appealing because he wants to get the big pockets back in the case, National Review and CEI, which is the think tank for our co-defendant, Rand Simberg. So all this is still going on, and it's going to go on for years and years and years on end. And Mark is actually going to be talking about that tonight to the Hillsdale crowd, and it actually is live streaming it at Hillsdale, and I'll provide a link when we post this show. There's also a link in the live notice, so that if you want to hear from Mark himself about the Mann case in his presentation to the nice folks at Hillsdale, that's going to be a great place to catch that up. Okay, let's see. Fran Lavery says, hello again, Melissa. The conversations about the exploding pagers makes it apparent that any device can be hacked. Voting machines, anyone? Well, I mean, that's it. That's a good point. How about some exploding voting machines? I hadn't noticed this before. It's sort of interesting. I went to vote in the Republican primary a few months ago, a short time ago. And It was the first time that my son has actually voted in person, because he'd been away at college and so had always sort of voted absentee. But as we left and put our ballots in the machine, he sort of like nudged me and he said, "Mom, look." And on the side it said, you know, Dominion voting. So it wasn't one of those Dominion machines, the screens, but it was a Dominion ballot counter, basically. I think they still hand count the actual votes, but it was just a reminder of all of that, all of that craziness from before. Okay, let's see. What's the next one? Johnny Woodrow writes, "Dear Mark, last week you made a very important point, one you've made repeatedly about the U.S. Constitution. It wasn't designed for the sheer number of people and diversity of cultures being crammed into the USA. As you often point out, it didn't prevent the slide into where we are now. It hasn't kept the quality of political candidates high or stopped politics becoming the puppet show of the donor classes." That's a very powerful and accurate statement, Johnny. "In the UK, we have the same cultural and demographic dynamics without a written constitution to appeal to or to blame, and yet we have the same puppet showing going on. Constitutions, written or unwritten, as a means of managing life together as a people with common values in a landmass, have failed. Here is my question. Do you think this is just how it goes? People organize and develop ways of managing life together? Those systems grow, become corrupt, collapse, and in the mess, new forms of local, legal, and political order emerge? Or are we witnessing something either entirely new or new in terms of the magnitude of population change, where the usual patterns of the rise and fall of civilizations have been interrupted, and so we are headed into unknown territory? Humanly speaking, I think I'm optimistic because although the sheer size of the demographic changes foisted upon so much of the globe in short order are new, human nature with its vices and virtues remains unchanged. And so some kind of sensible, local, small-scale political order will emerge again, simply because we have to live with our neighbors. From the theological perspective," I apologize, I'm mangling that. "From the theological perspective, I'm eternally optimistic, even if the West has lost sight of divine justice as the ultimate horizon of human history in all its cultural and political thinking, that doesn't mean the date with God is off and his plans have ceased. What thinkest you? Blessings, Johnny Woodrow." Well, that's a very perceptive point. I will say, actually, my master's is in theology, and the interesting thing, when you look at it from the theological perspective that that Johnny is talking about, it's true that we, at some point, you know, we don't know what God's plan is. And, you know, some things you do have to, certainly there is, you know, you're supposed to obviously take responsibility and do what you can, but we don't know the big picture necessarily. We don't know what's on the other side of this. And I think it's good to remember that we're just very sort of small little specks in the whole scheme of things here. Olga from Arizona. "Okay, I'll chime in on the electronics explosions too. Do those devices use the same lithium batteries as the ones that tend to spontaneously combust in the electric cars? Thank you, Melissa." I don't know. I don't think so. My recollection from, you know, I don't know what pagers are, what pagers use now, but my recollection is they use sort of like regular batteries that you had to change out. You know, like your AA or AAA or something like that. I think that's the case, but I don't know. That's a good question, and certainly something to look at. But obviously, there was nothing spontaneous about this. These weren't spontaneous combustions. They were sort of well planned. Keith Farrell writes, Democrats don't appear to have an off switch. What are the chances of Trump surviving until Election Day? Well, I mean, I don't know if you all saw this. I haven't been able to dig too far into the details. But, you know, just today they found, in Long Island, where President Trump is scheduled to speak, they found, a barrel with some explosives, a car, something near the site. So it's going to keep happening. They're going to keep trying. And at some point, I pray that this doesn't happen. But, you know, what are the odds? When you keep trying and trying and trying, something is going to happen. Jay Barney writes, Albanian, not Armenian. Ah, okay. Going back to, I think I was talking about the Independence Day event or whatever it was that had closed down the bridge. Albanian. Okay. I stand corrected. Steve from Manhattan, who is a lovely man and a wonderful cruiser. He joined us on the cruise. He's joined us on the cruise now and was in court with us in D.C. that miserable month. He was a great, wonderful support in all manner of things, from opening the door to helping, block certain individuals to just a great support, and wonderful to visit with at the end of the day to hear his perspective as a lawyer on what was happening. So Steve from Manhattan writes, Mark, it strikes me that if the latest would-be assassin, Ryan Wesley Ruth, ever makes it to trial, he should be able to defend himself using America's most expensive lawyers, mysteriously free of charge, on the grounds that he was fighting against election interference. After all, the Dems have asserted for at least 9 years that Donald Trump is nothing but a lean, mean election interference machine. Well, except for the lean part. If Mr. Ruth can get a Fort Lauderdale jury that is anything like the jury that Trump faced in Manhattan this May, or that you faced this January in D.C. Superior Court, won't Mr. Ruth soon be free to roam the fruited plains? Well, that would not surprise me. I guess I don't know. He would be, he didn't really pick a great venue to do this, if that was the case, because Florida, I think, isn't as friendly to that point of view as obviously the D.C. jury, which was completely stacked against us, or the New York jury that was completely stacked against Trump. But I think I read, maybe in the Daily Mail or one of those, that his son actually called him a potential martyr. And I'm sure that there will be others that will buy into that, to that same view. Okay, next. Chris Davies writes, Mark, I hope you are as well as can be, and hopefully we will get to see your Hillsdale talk on a special edition of the Mark Stein Show soon. We live in hope. You'll be able to watch the Hillsdale talk tonight. Hillsdale is live streaming it, and I'll make sure to send a link out to folks on that, so that if you want to tune in later tonight, that you can do so. And I think probably we will provide a link when they archive it later on. So if tonight doesn't work for you, which I think will be 1 o'clock in the morning your time, Chris, then I think that we'll post when they put the archive up. Anyway, Chris says, friend of the show and, of course, the Mark Stein Cruise, Ava Vlaardingerbroek posted on X today about the Netherlands' polite request for an opt-out from EU immigration policy. She is, as usual, quite right that the EU will not grant such a request, which raises the prospect of Nexit as the only alternative. How likely do you think Geert Wilders and his coalition partners would be to entertaining that possibility, please? As always, your thoughts would be most welcome. Keep well, Mark. Well, I'm certainly not as up to date on Euro policy as Mark and Ava are, but I think that would be quite an interesting development. And of course, Mark goes back with Geert quite some way. Mark wrote the foreword for his book, which you can get in the Stein store. And it's great to see that he's now in a position to perhaps affect this a nexit possibility. I wonder where all the it's an interesting proposal, and it would be sort of great if that happened, to sort of force the conversation about this whole refugee issue and quote unquote refugee, I'd say, and how to treat them. Anna Neiman writes, "Greetings, dear Mark. In this crazy kaleidoscope of leaders and would-be leaders, I can't really understand what Nigel Farage brings or has brought to the party. You have done such a service explaining Boris Johnson's performance as a general poop disturber. Can you clarify Nigel's role in our confusing current events?" Well, again, this is a bit out of my zone, above my pay grade. I don't know what all the different terms are. As I said earlier when I was talking about Ofcom, it's sort of, I feel very foreign when I'm in the UK, and I don't really understand. I don't really understand the politics there. I don't understand people that call themselves conservative that don't seem the least bit conservative to me. I mean, they're less conservative than, most liberal Democrats in the United States. So I don't understand it. And I don't know what's to come of Nigel. I see he's, I think it was yesterday he did another interview in which he was again separating himself from Tommy Robinson, which is something he does very well. He's always careful to, distance himself from anyone that sort of I don't even think it's my personal take, just in the little interactions of having had to deal with their crew when we were all doing a show together on GB News. I don't think he likes anyone that's of a that's as strong as he is, or stronger than he is. He likes to be the top dog. He doesn't like anyone else to be up there in that sphere with him. And I think, as much as he appears to want to distance himself from Tommy Robinson because of, I guess class issues, which aren't really a thing in America, but over there are, and, allegations of racism, which aren't true at all. I don't think that's it. I think it's just that he likes to be the top dog and he doesn't like to share the spotlight with anyone. And so, while it looks great that for him, I think it's like a safe move to distance himself. But at his core, my personal belief is that it's just part of his ego and his narcissism to he doesn't want to talk about anyone else that's at his level or stronger. I think he has to be the top dog and that's it. The notorious Mr. J writes, "For the second time, some nut job was preparing to off Trump. The bio that was leaked out has a very Lee Harvey Oswald flavor. No? Will this incident have any effect on the November outcome? Maybe not. If you believe the likes of Alan Lichtman, Trump's goose is well cooked to perfection. When you look at what passes for the policies of the two candidates, there's much to fear from both in any case. Trump is dangerously isolationist at the worst possible time in history. Harris is wedded and welded to divisive identity politics and mini-me Hugo Chavez type economics. No good can come of any of that. I don't think Trump is isolationist. I actually think Trump knows more about the rest of the world than most of these guys that have served as president. And mainly because his experience with the rest of the world is as a businessman. You know, he's got businesses around the world. He's created these golf courses around the world. He's traveled extensively. He's certainly married at least two non-American ladies. So I think he's not parochial. And I don't think he's necessarily an isolationist. I think he's interested in being involved to the extent of doing deals. So, you know, he was happy to go over and, you know, reach out to Kim Jong-un and, you know, do that famous little meeting there at the North Korean border. And, you know, he has said, I think in, maybe it was at the debate, it could have been somewhere else. I'm trying to remember where I heard him. But he was talking about, you know, if I'm elected, the first thing I'm doing, I'm getting on the phone with Putin. I'm getting on the phone with Zelensky, and we're going to, you know, we're going to solve this thing. So he's not isolationist to the fact to the extent that he wants to stay out completely, but that he doesn't want to, you know, get our troops into, you know, another Vietnam situation, you know, where people are, you know, have lost their lives, have had long time negative effects from Agent Orange, things like that. You know, I think his idea is that he doesn't want us to have to get into war. And so he wants to do deals. He's a deal maker. He wants to do deals. So I'm pro Trump. I agree with him, which he now has apparently recently confessed that he, you know, he kind of screwed up a little bit in the first go round, because, and understandably, because he came in from the outside. He didn't come in with an apparatus, a political apparatus, in the way that, you know, Bush would, you know, people that have served in public office. You wind up building a whole group of your people, or inheriting them from another candidate. He didn't come in with any of that. So he came in, he had to fill, I think, you know, 60,000 positions or whatever, and he couldn't get those positions filled. I mean, he didn't know enough people. He didn't have enough of an apparatus behind him to put his people into those positions. So what happens when you're trying to affect a particular policy and you can't put your people in those positions? Well, you have the carryovers, and those were the Obama people. And so you've got a whole bunch of people that are working against you. Then on top of all that, all the people that come to you offering their quote unquote help, you know, are really just trying to put, you know, not all, obviously, there are certainly people that are of good intentions, but, you know, people that are offering candidates to fill those government positions because it behooves them, their business, their corporation, their interests, and not to serve Trump's agenda. And so the one big glimmer of hope I have in terms of him appointing RFK Jr. to head the transition team is that RFK Jr. does know how it works. He knows how it works inside and out there. And if he's in charge of the transition and he's in charge of getting the people into those positions that need to be in that positions in order to affect Trump's agenda, I think it's going to be a very exciting and great thing. And my impression of Trump, and I don't really know him personally or anything like that. I've met him, you know, once. He's very friendly. But my impression of him is he's one of those big picture leader type guys. You know, I think that he will, you know, he's charged RFK Jr. with doing this, and he's going to let him run with it, and he's going to let him roll with it, and he's not going to, you know, try to micromanage that situation in the way like a Jimmy Carter would be a micromanager. He's going to let it go. And I think there's a lot of hope in that, because I think he's, RFK Jr. is, I don't agree with RFK Jr. on social issues or anything like that, but on some of these key issues, particularly free speech and the corruption, rooting out the corruption, I think he's all over it, and I think it'll be great to have him in charge of that. Let's see. George Pereira writes, Mark, the nice photo op spot in the fence is kept wide open. The oh-so-exalted Secretive Service can't even stroll around the fence line. The oh-so-secretive service doesn't have a dog to sniff out the fence line. It's not like some of the chunky agents from Butler couldn't use the exercise, as well as practice holstering their weapons. Oh, and a car was found near the latest President Trump rally with explosives in it, and as expected, the official denial followed a few minutes later. One more thing. Linda Graham Nasty passed on playing golf with President Trump on Sunday. Just saying. Well, you know, it's a good point about the fence line. It's very strange. The point about the dog is actually pretty important. We always had to do that with when I used to be involved in helping to liaise with, you know, Secret Service on White House events in New Hampshire. Everyone has to get out. The dog comes in, does some sniffing around. Yeah, it's weird that they didn't even have, you know, sort of a dog out there sniffing out what's going on. Or the fact that this was a photo, a spot that paparazzi, I guess you'd call them, had used in the past. So it's a known weak spot. So I don't know. I guess there'll be a lot of questions left to come on that. I think there's time for one more question, and I'm just looking to see if I can find it. Bear with me a moment. This has to do with... Oh, gosh. Where is this guy? There was a question about, Stefan Busek. I hope I haven't mutilated that. Mark, greetings from sunny SoCal. Acknowledging that you have moved analysis of your niche Canadian musical observations to Saturday, that there might be more time to discuss who is 2 points up in Pennsylvania, I would like to ask you about the one piece of music that you do still play on Clubland Q&A, that being your theme song. Does it have a title? Who wrote it? Who arranged it? It's a wonderful composition. As the old commercial said, inquiring minds want to know. Even if mine is the only one. God richly bless you, sir. So, Stefan, that's Nine Lives, written by Mark, composed by Kevin Amos. You can hear it on... Mark's Feline Groovy CD, which is available at the Stein Store. And I'm going to play that for you in full as we close out today. One thing I do want to remind folks is that we do have this cruise coming up in April. It's super fun. We're doing it with Celebrity Cruises. We're doing it on the Celebrity Apex, which is a pretty new ship. I got to tour it myself when I was in the UK to attend that god-awful Ofcom trial. And the tour was fantastic. I mean, the ship is just has so much going for it. It's... so many innovations. It's has a lot of various gathering operations. The theater is fantastic. The balcony rooms are really cool. One of the things on the old cruise ships, there was sort of a, I mean, this is like first world problems, right? The one thing I didn't like about those balconies is that I don't like having to breathe in, you know, air conditioning, you know, sort of stale air all the time. So whenever I was in my cabin, I would try to prop my balcony door open with, you know, one of the chairs, and they're very heavy. So you have to really, you know, carefully try to hold it open, and then the wind comes and it slams shut very loud. And, you know, it's sort of a pain trying to keep that door open so that you get the fresh air coming in into your cabin. This new ship that we're on is so cool because instead of that, you know, as I said, first world problem, trying to keep the balcony door open on your cruise ship, is they have these, it's an extended balcony so that it makes the room larger, but also it allows you the opportunity to, you know, sort of there's like this, you know, electric switch that you can bring down and open up the balcony to the outside, the window. So you're getting fresh air, you can close it up, it's a great thing. And so there's all sorts of neat new things that are available on the ship that I think people will like. A lot of great options for various kinds of food. The dining room situation is completely different. Instead of one big dining room, there's four smaller dining rooms. And so that's also going to make it easier when we're all at dinner. Those of you who have joined us on the cruises before have talked about sometimes it's difficult to hear people across from the table from you because of the, you know, the largeness of the dining room space. But these new dining situations are going to be more intimate. It's going to be a lot easier to hear at the tables. We like to, you know, people get a chance to sit at least, you know, a few of the nights with one of the special guests, you know, people that are speaking, participating in the cruise. And so I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's a great time to see Mark, visit with Mark, and then also just hang out with people that think like you, generally. And this is a great camaraderie that's involved. There's a lot of fun nights, you know, and a lot of good information in the, you know, sort of panel. We have these shows earlier in the day that people go to and get to hear from Mark and get to hear from our guests and then talk about it afterwards. So I think it'll be fun. We're going to be, as I said in the time recitation at the beginning, we're going to be departing from Barcelona on April 6th. And we're going to make our way through from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. We'll have a stop in Lisbon, Portugal. We're going to have a great stop in Porto, Portugal, which is where port wine is famously named after. And unusual for cruises, it's actually going to be an overnight there, so that you'll have plenty of time to really explore and have fun in that little gem part of the world. Then from Porto to La Coruña, Spain, which is famous for great food, great seafood. There's a sort of a Celtic edge to the place as well. And then the cruise will end at Southampton in England, across the channel. So we have Michelle Bachmann. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann is returning, as is our dear friend of the show, Leilani Dowding is coming back. Samantha Smith is coming back. We also have some new guests that are coming, and they are specifically our former GB News colleagues that are coming out of solidarity with Mark for what Mark has gone through with GB News and Ofcom, and what they all have gone through as well with GB News and Ofcom. And that's Lawrence Fox, some of you know him as Laza, Father Calvin Robinson, and of course our famous and beloved Kiwi Dan Wooten. So I am informed by the cruise authority that the cruise ship is filling up. They also have regular guests that buy cabins, so that it's important that our group gets in and gets the cabins that we want before the ship is sold out. So if you're thinking about coming and you want to have the widest opportunity of the type of cabin that you're looking for, you know, please take a look at that. I note that the amounts on the website are in U.S. dollars, not pounds. So just calculate that in your little calculations. And it includes everything. And so we also have packages that are part of our thing. So it includes all the costs of the program, includes all the food, includes all the cruising, includes there's a drinks package that's included in that. There's a Wi-Fi package that's included in that. So it's really just, you know, it might be a little bit of a sticker shock up front, but know that, you know, after that, there's not really going to be any expenses unless you like book a massage or things like that. So give it a thought. The website is marksteincruise.com, and we will be so delighted to see you on board. And again, Hillsdale College tonight, Mark, we'll send out the link for that so you can hear the man personally. And thank you so much for your patience and your indulgence in hearing from me today, so that Mark could just stay totally focused on his on what he's got to do today. And as I said, give it all the welly that it deserves. So here we go. We're going to close out with Nine Lives, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Nine lives. You got nine lives to live. You only get out what you put in, so no pussyfooting. You get just nine lives to live. She was the next door tabby, hers and playful swipes. I was a clumsy kitten, I'd yet to earn my stripes. Her eyes held a gleam and beckoned me toward her sorcerer cream. My life had just begun, life number one. Nine lives, you got nine lives to live. You only get out what you put in, so no pussy puttin'. You got just nine lives to live. She was a green-eyed black cat, and she crossed my path. I was a cat on hot bricks, hey, you can do the math. She knew everything, and she unwound me like a big ball of string. And it was all so new, life number two. You got nine lives to live. You only get out what you put in, no pussy puttin'. You got just nine lives to live. She was a ginger hellcat, how she'd hiss and scratch. Hadn't a cat in hell's chance, I knew I'd met my match. Life with no taboo, the milk was spilt and man, the fur really flew. And we ran wild and free, life number three. Nine lives. doll with fluffy face. Five lives, the mouse are daring me to chase. Six lives, seven, the memories I can erase. Each purr and hairball. Nine lives, you got nine lives to live. You only get out what you put in, so no pussy puttin'. You got just nine lives to live. She said to me one morning, face it, you're not young. What's with that tail you're chasing? Yeah, that cat got my tongue. Why just cat around when what you seek you may have already found? Was she my one soulmate? Or just life number eight? Nine lives, you got nine lives to live. You only get out what you put in. Of cream, some you drained, some you spilled, and you gotta savor every saucer, cause there ain't any mossa, but you lived nine lives to the hill.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media.